So yeah, I have since the days of, so I did olfactory transduction as a grad student, and right now I've really jumped off the deep end. So today I'm going to talk about behavior. But before I start, I want to thank Anne-Marie and Bob for the great conference and for giving me the opportunity to speak here. And the work that I'm going to present is a solo effort by an exceptional postdoctoral fellow, Sung-Hae Jung. Basically, I'm going to talk about odor-guided locomotion. And we designed a new behavioral paradigm that allowed us to look at a fly's locomotion in response to carefully controlled odor stimuli. And we studied the responses, behavioral responses to attractive odors using this paradigm, and came to the basic conclusion that behavioral response to attractive odors are unlikely to be a single motor program, but rather they are organized into independently controlled behavioral modules. And so before I launch into my talk, I want to introduce you to my model organism, because this is the first fly talk here. So basically, and this is going to be a very brief introduction. I know most of you probably know all of this, but you know, like most animals, flies use olfactory sense for a variety of vital everyday tasks, like finding food or finding mate, deciding where to lay eggs, and so on and so forth. The olfactory system in the fly is organized around along similar lines to the mammalian olfactory system. And basically, the nose of the fly is the antenna and the maxillary palp. These house the olfactory receptor neurons. And each olfactory receptor neuron, there are 1,500 of them. They express one out of a large family, 60, of 60. So they express one member of that family, and depending on which receptor they express, they go to a given glomerulus, and there they contact a second order neurons. And these second order neurons also are uniglomerular to a large extent. And so this sets up a one-to-one relationship between olfactory receptor neuron, glomerulus, and projection neurons. And again, as in mammals, a given odor will bind to multiple receptors, and thereby change, influence the activities in multiple OR classes, and thereby activate multiple glomerulus and multiple projection neurons, right? And so the upshot of all of this is just that an odor is represented by a pattern of active wiring classes, or glomeruli, or PNs, and the essential function of the olfactory system is to take this pattern and decode it to form the basis of perception and behavior. And so what I'm going to talk about is try to explore how the pattern of activity is decoded into one very important form of behavior, that is the control of locomotion. Okay. And so when we talk about odor-gated locomotion, I think that the predominant thing that one thinks about is locomotion to find the source of odor. These are two examples. So here, a dog is finding a pheasant, I think. And so there are lights attached to the dog, and you can therefore visualize its track as it finds its odor source. And this is a human example following a trail of chocolate. And to a greater or smaller extent, almost every animal can do this task. And if you have popped open a bottle of wine or beer, or even a single malt whiskey, you will know that fruit flies are also excellent at this task. And in the case of, and this problem has been very intensely studied across a range of model and non-model organisms. And I think that this task breaks down into, you can divide it into two parts. The first is of sensory processing, and so there are lots of questions regarding sensory processing related to this particular problem. In the flies, people have mostly focused on the pattern of odorant classes that define that an odor is attractive and worth going to, right? And the second set of problems is, once you've decided that something is attractive, what's the motor program or what's the behavioral algorithm that allows you to find the source of odor, right? And so these are some of the papers that relate to this problem in the fly, but obviously this is an intensely studied subject. And what one limitation here is that the olfactory system, even with 60 odorant classes in the fly, and much more so for mice with so many different receptors, will essentially recognize almost any chemical out in the world, right? So any volatile out there, you'll find an olfactory receptor neuron that responds to it. But this step where you see robust attraction is only seen to a very small number of compounds, at least has been demonstrated maybe about one compound per species on an average, or a handful of compounds per species. And so that raises the question that because a vast majority of odors are likely to be salient, so what about the locomotor response to these odors? Do animals essentially ignore most of the odors that are not salient, or odor tracking is just one out of a range of behavioral responses that an animal can perform? And so, to state this problem differently, in a second way, one option is that different odors activate different pattern of odorant classes, and based on what pattern is active, you can decide that an odor is repellent or an attractant in some cases, but in most cases you ignore it, and when you decide that it's something of importance, you start a motor program to either be attracted to the odor or repelled by the odor, depending on what your perceived value of the odor. Alternatively, there can be a continuum. So in this case, I'm talking only about locomotion. So that a pattern of odorant classes, active odorant classes, can signal a range of salience. And based on that range of salience, you have a range of locomotor plans. And so these are the basic thoughts in our mind as we designed this particular essay, which I'm going to talk about next. So this is a very simple behavioral essay. This is the side view schematic. This is a view from the top. And essentially, a circular arena. The flies are constrained to walk. So there's two plexiglass plates, and the flies can walk anywhere within that circle, but cannot fly, etc. Odor is coming from the top, and there's a plastic mess here, so the odor crosses the plastic mess, and then there's a vacuum here that sucks out the odor. The thing that I'm going to skip over today, and I'm happy to talk later about it, is we put in a lot of effort to characterize this arena, and the characteristics we wanted to achieve was that this central zone of odor, what we call the odor zone, has a constant flux of odor. And outside the central zone, there is no odor at all. So inside is a constant flux of odor, outside there's nothing at all. And so one advantage of that is that we know precisely what the fly experienced and when it experienced. And this what we experienced is, what we can do is replicate the same stimulus back in the rig and figure out which warrants are active. Right? And so this is the behavior, you know, tracks of the fly in this arena. What you see is that before the odors, the flies sort of hang out at the border, and then they make these forays to go inside the odor zone. Right now there's no odor, but after some time when the odor is turned on, and when they make these forays, their behavior changes. So this is apple cider vinegar, it's an attractive odor, so they spend much more time inside the odor. And we can use these tracks to try to understand how the locomotion changed in response to odor. And we can also ask how much time it's spending inside in the presence of a particular odor, and therefore get how attractive a given odor is to the fly, right? And so the first experiment we did was compared the behavioral response to two attractive odors. So this is, again, attraction index, zero is no attraction, so this is solvent control. One odor, this is apple cider vinegar, second odor, 2-butanone. Both of these are attractive, but apple cider vinegar is much more attractive compared to the 2-butanone. And if you look at the tracks of the fly, so this are tracks of a single fly and the same fly in response to these two odors. You can see that there is an obvious difference in their behavior. In response to apple cider vinegar, they sort of hug the border much more. And when they leave the odor zone, they make the sharp turns to get back. In the case of 2-butanone, it's much more of a circular walk that takes them again and again through the arena. Right? Now, these obvious differences turned out to be real. So basically, we perform very intensive analysis of what's going on here. And we came to two basic conclusions. The first is that odor modulation of locomotion is very complex. What that means is that we started out thinking that it would be just some simple modulation of speed and turn rate, and that's all, but that was not the case. And the second thing is, this modulation is dependent on the identity of odor, as you can see. And I will expand on these ideas in the next few slides. What I'll do is first show you some of the parameters, some of the kinds of locomotor parameters that change during odor exposure. And then I'm going to perform a more formal statistical analysis of this. So this is an example of modulation of speed. So what is plotted here is change in speed as a function of time. The zero here is the time it enters the odor zone. And each of these traces constitute average across many entries, across many, many flies. And what you can see is that there's a robust decrease in the speed as the fly enters the odor zone when apple cider vinegar is present, which is not seen in the case of 2-butanone. Similarly, when the flies exit the arena, there is again an increase in speed that is odor dependent. So this is an example of a differential modulation of speed. And we can show, the next slide I'll show you an example of turn. Now, turning by itself, it turns out to be very complex in flies. So flies can just do a very smooth turn without dropping any velocity. And they can turn quite fast with a low radius while not dropping velocity. Or they can stop and change their direction. Or what is plotted here is in these black dots describe a special kind of turn, which is a very sharp, essentially like a three-point turn. And the important and the interesting thing here is that in both odors, the overall rate of sharp turn changes. But in the case of apple cider vinegar, the turn rate is particularly high right at the odor border, whereas you don't see that for 2-butanone. And so you can see that these differences are unexpected and really subtle. And here is another example, this time with run-stop statistics. So these are plots of speed over a zoomed-out axis, so that you can see runs and the interspersed with stops. Now, in the presence of, in the absence of odor, you see many long stops, which are now gone in the presence of both apple cider vinegar and 2-butanone. Additionally, in the case of apple cider vinegar, the run speed is much decreased in the presence of odor. You don't see such decrease in 2-butanone. So that's a single fly, and these are population averages. Again, you can see lots of short duration stops in the presence of both odors, but the run duration and run velocity is only changed in the case of apple cider vinegar and not 2-butanone. So all of these parameters were meant to give you a flavor of the complexity as well as the odor dependence of this behavior. But as all of you appreciate, studying single parameter at a time it can be dangerous, because these parameters could be all correlated to each other, so you're again seeing the same behavior again and again. So to make it more, to analyze these things more formal, we created essentially a behavioral space, a number of parameters all together, and we came up with a 17-parameter behavioral space. And 17 seems like a lot, but if you consider the fact that if you just take speed, speed is modulated differently inside the odor zone and outside the odor zone. So that's two. Speed is modulated differently over a 1-second time scale, the plots that I showed you. And there's another modulation of speed that occurs over a minute time scale. So so for speed alone, there are four parameters right there, right? And so 17 is actually a very low number. And so this is our 17-parameter space. I think it's not necessary to go through individual parameters. I think the identity of these parameters at this moment do not hold great relevance. The more important point is that we have a high-dimensional representation of behavior. And that will allow us to do things that one could not do with a single parameter. But what basically each of these parameters, the dotted line represents no change, what it would be when there's no change. And then you have the effect on the solvent control as well as on those two odors. So one of the reasons to have a high dimensional space is now if all of these parameters were correlated to a single parameter, then this 17-dimensional space would then collapse to a single-dimensional space. But in fact, if you look at the cross-correlation matrix, so these are pairwise correlations, and you can see that most pairwise correlations are very low. And these are the few that are significantly correlated to each other. So what this means is that the 17-dimensional parameter space that the behavior does live in a high-dimensional space. And we can also demonstrate this using PCA. If you perform PCA, we need about 6 parameters to get 90% of variance in the data. So the odor modulation of behavior lives in a high-dimensional space. The other way to say is that there are many parameters that are independently modulated by odors. And this high-dimensional space also allows us to demonstrate that the behavioral response due to apple cider vinegar and 2-butanone were indeed distinct. To do that, we essentially do canonical variate analysis, where the first dimension is the dimension that captures most of the difference between these two, the two groups of data. And you can see that along the first canonical variate, there is a good separation between the responses to the two odors. And one A caveat here is that when you have a high dimensional space, you can separate anything from anything else. So that's the control experiment where you do the same analysis, but if you switch the labels, only a very small fraction have a greater mean than in the original set, implying that these responses are indeed distinct. And so all of this boils down to the fact that if you choose two orders, both are attractive, but attractive to a different level, then you get qualitatively different motor programs, right? So these are not just scaled up versions of each other. And this, this is consistent with the idea that there is an attraction-repulsion continuum, and that if an order is more attractive, you have a different motor program, and that in fact leads to a more attractive behavior. And so, to test this idea more rigorously, what you can do is ask what is the modulus of locomotion look for orders that are similarly attractive. And to ask, to do this, we essentially diluted the concentration of apple cider vinegar until we found that the attraction index matched well. So now this is apple cider vinegar at 100-fold dilution, and they're as about equally attractive with 2-butanol. And when you do this, the differences in behavior still persist. So the decrease in speed that you saw earlier is still there, and it's the same with the turn rate. And we, you know, we went through all of the 17 parameters, and we saw using the canonical variate analysis that the responses of the dilute vinegar is still different compared to 2-butanol. So what that means is that even when you have the same level of traction, you have qualitatively different motor program. And so, so essentially, you know, in so many words, it means that the level of traction is not particularly informative about the underlying locomotion, right? And so, essentially, you know, just to revisit, I mean, started with two ideas, that of binary classification and that of attraction repulsion continuum, and now we have ended up at a point where both of these ideas do not really explain much of the underlying locomotion. And so what we did was we essentially did away with this step because it was not explaining much, and we started thinking about how does the pattern of one activation relates to the motor parameters that are modulated. And essentially, the way we approached this problem was focus on apple cider vinegar. So remember that we can replicate the same concentration of odor in the rig, and that's what we did. We recorded from every single ORN class, and with the same concentration of odor that we did behavioral experiments with, and found that under our conditions, there are 7 ORN classes that are activated by apple cider vinegar. And so now, so we have the neural representation of apple cider vinegar. That's, you know, I haven't written out all the parameters, but you have the behavioral effect of apple cider vinegar. And now to ask what is the contribution of these different ORN classes to the behavior, we activate and inactivate different sets of ORN classes. So this is the first example. So here we are activating OR42B ORNs. Although most odors activate multiple ORN classes, if you decrease the concentration enough, you will only activate the most sensitive ORNs. And previous work has told us that ethyl acetate is particular, OR42B is particularly sensitive to ethyl acetate. And so, so we used low concentration of ethyl acetate, and then they asked what's the behavioral effect of using low concentration of ethyl acetate. And so this is again those 17 parameters. And you have, if you look at attraction, there is no change, there's no attraction to just activating a single glomerulus, but these two parameters, they change. than in the presence of odor. So there's a decrease in run duration, and there's an increase in angular velocity, angular speed. And so, this is activation of OR42B with ethyl acetate. We can also play the same trick with low concentrations of apple cider vinegar. And when we do, we again see the same result. So that's apple cider vinegar, and this is ethyl acetate. And you can see that again, there's no attraction, but there is change in run duration and angular speed. And we can demonstrate this yet another way by using an OR42B mutant. And so what we'll do here is ask, how does the response of apple cider vinegar compare to the wild type and the mutant? And again, if you look at overall attraction, there's no difference in the overall attraction in the mutant, but the change in run duration that we saw with the wild type is not seen in the mutant, and the angular speed still changes, but there is a decrease in this change of angular speed going from the wild type to the mutant. So all of this say that if you activate one ORN class, you do not mediate strong attraction, but you change a subset of motor programs. And we did this exercise for four ORN classes, and two of them you didn't get anything, nothing changed. And for the other one, we again didn't get any attraction, but you changed some other motor parameters and not these. And so that led us to the idea that different ORN classes modulate different motor parameters. Another way to see this is to make a bigger perturbation. So out of these seven ORN classes, three require a cofactor, IR8A, for to be functional. And so in an IR8 and mutant, these three ORN classes are gone, and you have only four remaining. And what you see is that, somewhat amazingly, attraction has decreased only slightly. And so attraction to apple cider vinegar is deep and very, very robust to perturbation. However, you start changing many more parameters than the two. So if you take out a bigger chunk, you affect four parameters. And so all of this led us to the following hypothesis, following model, where different ORN classes, so the better way to say is different motor parameters are modulated by a subset of ORN classes, of active ORN classes. And vice versa, a given ORN class participates in the modulation of a subset of parameters. And so the overall conclusion is that first I showed you that odor modulation of locomotion lives in a high dimensional space, or in other words, many parameters are modulated independently to modulate locomotion. And that the relationship between level of attraction and motor program is not very strong at all. The same odor as you increase the concentration of odor, and you get more and more attraction, more parameters would be engaged. But if you compare completely different odors, you don't get any relationship between level of attraction and motor program. And then individual ORN classes affect some motor parameters and not others. And so the implications of this result is that, so at least when I started doing this experiment, my vision was that that a fly or an animal is just sitting there, or roaming around, and then it smells the odor and makes a snap decision that is attractive or it's repulsive or it completely ignores it, right? One of the three. I think that after Right now, my view is more that the animal at all times is executing a search strategy. And different stimuli, like vision, audition, all of these will affect how it navigates an environment, and odors are one such cue that will modulate the search strategy. And this modulation is not simply, it's not just binary, but it's much more varied. So that's one implication. And the what I also want to point out that that right now we don't have a full answer, obviously, of what, why the modulation is like this, or why the modulation is like this, or organized like that. And the other thing I want to really point out is that all of this study focuses on the average behavior across flies and across the 3-minute odor period, right? And so this is the average behavior of a hungry fly. And I don't want you to go away with the impression that if you activate a set of O-ring class, something is got to happen, right? So all of these steps can be under constant modulation, which can depend both on the context, on the immediate context, as well as the state of the animal, like hunger and so on. So there is no constraint so far on being modulated. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, Joe. So your last point there, do you have any data for that? So have you tried to change the context by changing the shape of your odor zone or the color of something or anything, right? Do you have any data to show how much context changes?
Yeah, that only anecdotal, not enough to quantify properly. The two big things are, first of all, it changes with time. So during our three minute, the full encounter is different from the second encounter with the odor, third encounter, and so on. And the different parameters, they change at a different rate with odor exposure. So that's one. The second is the state. So this is all the data I showed you are 16-hour hungry flies. 4-hour hungry flies behave differently. So that's state dependence. Yeah, so those are two.
So sure. I have a question. You speak about the 5-motor program, and however, they have the flies have all the same amount, the motor neurons and the muscles and everything. So this motor program are directed from the brain or from the muscles of the leg, because is it possible that vinegar also acting on the receptor on the leg?
Yeah, these are definitely from olfaction, because yeah. So we worried about that after a lot of our mutants did not so any diminishment of response. But you can make several perturbations to show that all of these behaviors are olfactory behaviors. And the ones we did was, so there is another mutant called OR83B mutant that takes out 70% of the ORN classes. And in the OR83B mutant, if you take out the antenna, you take out all responses. Another perturbation is if you take out, there's a triple mutant, OR83B, IR8A, and IR25A. If you have a triple mutant, that will take out all of olfaction. And again, you take out all behavioral response to apple cider vinegar. So one thing to note here is that even at the highest concentrations we use, we are still at a fairly low concentration.
If you take out mushroom bodies, do they do the same problem? That's my question.
I don't know anything about taking, yeah, we yes, so all of these receptors go to the antenna lobe. The neurons go to the antenna lobe, and then they pass off the signal to projection neurons, which then go to higher brain centers.
So that was really cool. I'm wondering about associative learning. So have you tried that at all? And if you haven't, can you speculate, would it just change the valence but the motor pattern would be the same, or would you expect that there would be a change in the motor pattern as well?
Right, yeah, no, we haven't tried. It is hard to speculate. I think that I would not be surprised if you can change the valence without affecting the motor program very much. I also would not be surprised if associative learning changes some of these motor parameters and leaves other intact. Right. So yeah, both are possible.
Can you use this setup to look at Drosophila larvae? Because I know they're strongly attracted to most things, but I was wondering if you see the same variation in all of these different parameters, if they still show a wide variety of different parameters.
Right, so we haven't tried any larvae, and I think that, yeah, I think you can try. You just take a small modification of the setup. And I think that would be a very good experiment, because I feel like flies and adult flies and larvae are fundamentally different in terms of their navigation strategy. The flies have this, are just very, they have many more knobs that they can play with. And how the behavior changes with larvae would be a very good experiment.
Very nice talk, and I have two questions. One is, in your answer before to Joel, you said that the programs change in time of exposure.
Right.
So my question is, when do you count, or when do you define attraction? Because one of the papers that you had on your list there of Jing Wang showed attraction to 5% cider vinegar in a 42B dependent
right.
manner.
Right.
So that's question one. Question two. And in my mind, by the way, that could be a difference in the assay or a difference in when you call the attraction. But I wonder, when did you call it? And then the other question is, if I'm not mistaken, in one of your early slides, you showed that upon entering the zone of the odor, of the attractive odor, there was an increase in locomotion. So that's in contrast to a beautiful paper in another species by Corey Bergman, who showed in C. elegans that when they are in a happy environment, they slow down, and when they are in an unhappy or not good environment, they start moving fast, which is much more intuitive than, if I understood correctly, what mm-hmm. you showed.
Okay, so the first question was, the discrepancy between our result and Jing Wang's result regarding OR42B.
Just when do you call the attraction?
Yeah, so for our attraction, it's we measure attraction starting from the first time the fly encounters odor till the end of the odor period. It's 3 minutes. But you can count in any window. We don't get attraction with OR42B. One big difference between his work and ours, and we just could not replicate that, is that he starves the flies for 4 days, and in our hands all the flies die when you starve them for 4 days. So I don't know what food he's feeding them. Yeah, I know. Our flies are wimpy. So that's one. And so with respect to apple cider vinegar, you know, they do decrease speed when they go. Yeah, there's a decrease in speed, and there's an increase in speed when they leave the arena.
I wonder if there's some type of dominant motor programs. Have you tried to mix the two odors and see if it mimics one of the two, or is it a completely new program?
No, we haven't yet tried. I know the last time we met, you asked me to do the experiment, but yeah, we haven't gotten to it. We will do that. I think it's a good experiment. Yeah, go ahead.
So one thing I noticed, I'm definitely on board with the idea that these behaviors to different odors are different. But there were features in, for example,
the response, I think, to apple cider vinegar, the attractive odor, where they circled the edge.
Right.
And that kind of higher order structure is not perhaps easily captured by a simple modulation of atomic behavioral
right.
features. So yeah. I wonder if you have tried methods to capture
yeah.
that kind of higher order structure.
That's right. I mean, I think that's what we are doing at present. And I think that, that's why I took some pains to say that the 17 parameter space is not complete. And so basically, I think that not quite ready with that step, but essentially, what we did was we tried a simple Markov model to fit this, and that didn't work at all. And so when we tried hierarchical Markov model, so if you have three states in the hierarchy, you can explain, you can get most of the features in the behavior. But we are not ready yet, yeah.
So I was wondering if you thought about trying aversive odorants as well as attractive,
yeah.
and if you see sort of an inverse behavioral pattern that might tell you something about how the nervous system strings together these primitives in, sort of stereotype ways.
Right. So we went with attraction first for a very simple practical reason that the repulsive odor, the most commonly used repulsive odor for a fly is CO2. And if you expose the fly to CO2 in this environment, even at fairly low concentration, they essentially experience it once, and then they go and sit in a corner, making analysis of tracks impossible because there are no tracks. But essentially, we are getting to it now. And the question really is whether if you have different repulsive odors, would you see the same diversity, or is repulsion, again, a unitary phenomena, that repulsion is repulsion, run away? So we don't know yet.
I was going to ask a question, but I think you may have already answered it. When you talked about what I was going to ask is if you had tried to model these, the amplitudes of these primitives mm-hmm. as weights of motor units and basically tried to reconstruct trajectories and see if they look like anything that a real fly produces. But is that what you meant by the Markov model? Is
no,
that
so the Markov model, so this framework is not very good at all because these parameters are gotten from averaging across a large chunk of time. And I think that for many of these parameters, these are not defined on a moment-by-moment basis because they're on or off and stuff like that. And so with the hierarchical model, you just essentially put some feature like, say, speed or angular speed, and then you basically propagate it using a model, right? And so, yeah, there's a bunch of many different models. And we are essentially working through that. Yeah.
So if you try many different attractive odors, do you see distinct pattern of behavior? I mean, to the number of the chemicals you try, or do they converge into a few?
Right. So so basically, we haven't tried that many odors, but very closely, things that are close to each other, like apple cider vinegar and banana, you can still pull out differences between apple cider vinegar and banana. And similarly, 2-butanone and ethyl butyrate. So basically, complex or simple, it's not complex versus simple, and so on. But I think that this data set is not the perfect, good data set to answer that question, because although you can get an average answer across flies, but there's a lot of individual variance between fly to fly. And so to ask that question, what you have to do is take a single fly and give it 50 odors, and then ask how things cluster, right?
Yeah. If you can see the behavior, can you tell what
right.
the fly is smelling?
Exactly, yeah. But we, yeah. So for that, we need that data set. I say, yeah, it's a very fundamental question, obviously.
Does the attraction does the attraction that you see, or the extent of attraction, correlate to the attraction you'd see when they experience a gradient? Because you're saying there's no gradient.
Can you repeat the question?
So if you measure the degree of attraction that you see in your setup, does that correlate with the degree of attraction you would see in a gradient assay? Because here you said you purposely designed it right so that there's no gradient. They're either so they don't really know. I mean, I guess eventually they could learn this, but they don't really know when they're going to be in the odor, right, until they get there?
Right.
So I guess I'm just wondering if the attraction, does it correlate with more of a, like, naturalistic setting where they can sense a gradient and go toward the odor?
Right. So I think that I can say two things. The first thing is after they encounter the odor once, they clearly know how to get to it, because one of the parameters is time to return, and that changes dramatically. And that's one of the things that is correlated across all attractants. So in our setup, the thing that correlates with attraction index most strongly is time to return. So that's one thing. So they do know how to get to the odor, although it's completely dark, and they don't have a cue. So it's some kind of navigation. So your second question. So if you do similar analysis in the normal scenario of a point source of odor and however they are spreading, you recover similar parameters basically.
I hope this is a new question. do you follow the parameters outside of the center after they leave the odor?
Sorry?
Do you follow the 17 parameters after they come out of the center disk? Or
right. So the 17 parameters includes both things that happen inside and outside. So there are some parameters that relate to things that happen inside and some outside. Yeah. So essentially, the 17, the first row all to do with the spatial distribution, different aspects of spatial distribution. And so this is time inside transit, so how much time they spend inside when they get there. This is time to return, so obviously this is happening outside. And similarly, you have speed inside and speed outside, and so on.
But have you tried to split them and see, for example, if their turning pattern is different when they are exposed versus afterwards, or?
Turning pattern is different whether they're exposed to odor or not. Outside, yes, it is different, yes.
So do flies leave scent tracks like rodents? Because, I mean, in a mouse, they would be, if it was in the dark, they would be following the smell of their feet, which would be changing their behavior.
Right.
I mean, they can sense, obviously they can sense odors on their feet. Do they leave odors?
Almost certainly they do, because we haven't studied it, but we try to avoid it essentially by every day, you at the end of the day, after you've done 3 or 4 flies, you clean it up with ethanol. Otherwise, you see the flies stay at a given point, and you see weird things.
Within a trial, so have you looked at the actual track that a fly is making, and how does its track actually influence its prior
track? Its own track.
Right.
Now that is possible. No, we haven't analyzed that, but definitely some flies repeat a pattern in the arena. So they go along same paths again and again, but that could be due to odor or other things, right?
But that would be a very simple mechanism for them to map the whole space. It's just slime molds can solve mazes by just avoiding their tracks. So,
yeah. It is plausible. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, speaker again.
If I understand correctly, we are done. Is that right?
We're done.
Okay. All right. Have a nice dinner, everyone.